from Minnesota to Tennessee, North Dakota to Louisiana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, an eviction moratorium during a pandemic sounds like a good idea, but then how does the property owner pay his bills? Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute is here to discuss. The passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has triggered an election year battle over a key seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Are California's forest fires really caused by climate change? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets the answer from Myron Ebel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about the influence of Karl Marx on the anti-statue movement on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Many states and President Trump have placed a temporary moratorium on evicting people who are unable to pay their rent. But that policy has significant economic implications. Yaron Brook is chairman of the board of directors of the Ayn Rand Institute. He is here to discuss the impact of the eviction moratorium. Yaron, welcome to American Radio Journal. Yaron, to set the stage here, tell us what the president has done and what we've seen states like California have done when it comes to moratoriums on evictions, and this for people who are renting houses, apartments, condos, whatever.
Congress was actually the first to act on this. We saw this in the stimulus bill in the CARES Act, where there was a moratorium on evictions. So if you didn't pay your rent, landlords could not evict you. And then when that expired, many states extended that. So about 14 states, including California, basically extended that into next year. And what the president has now done is he's expanded that nationwide. So he's expanded that to all 50 states. And basically what he says is, it says is if you don't pay your rent, if you're renting, and if you don't pay your rent, and the landlord cannot evict you. In other words, he cannot, there's no recourse against you if you don't pay your rent. Now, you still owe that rent, theoretically. That is, when the moratorium expires in January 1st, you will still owe that rent. And at that point, theoretically, evictions could happen. But the idea here is, and this was done under kind of the CDC power, public health power, is the idea is we don't want to create more homeless people. We don't want to throw people out during the middle of a pandemic. That will create even more problems. And therefore, we are making it impossible to evict a renter based on their inability to pay the rent.
Of course, nobody wants to see people kicked out of their house or their apartment, especially in the midst of a pandemic. However, let's talk about the flip side of that coin, Yaron, and that is from the perspective of the landlord. Now, the term landlord in and of itself makes people think of somebody rolling in money and they're just preying on the less fortunate, but are not a lot of times the landlords, small business people who also have bills to pay, because I would assume that the electric bill, the heating bill, et cetera, doesn't go away even if they're not getting rent or a mortgage payment. So what's the impact on the property owner?
Well, it's potentially devastating on the property owner. I mean, the property owner could be a small business person, but it could be a large business that owns condo complexes and builds those complexes, maintains those complexes, has massive loans on those complexes. They employ hundreds, maybe thousands of people. Their livelihood is now at stake. These, from the small person, from the person who's supplementing his income by maybe having bought a few houses, taking on mortgages on those houses, and getting rent on those, to the large corporation, all of those are now threatened. Their income is threatened. Their ability to pay the bank is threatened. Their ability to pay a mortgage is threatened. And of course, from a purely economic perspective, think that how that cycles through the economy. If these people can't pay their loans to the banks are hurting. The banks might call in other loans that might put other businesses in danger. So there are real macroeconomic consequences. But on the personal level, what happens to people who have a few homes and now pay the mortgages and maintain the home and pay the bills, and now their source of income is dried up? It's gone to zero. Are they going to have to file for bankruptcy? Are they going to be able to pay the mortgages on these homes? Maybe default, but what about their own home? What about their own family? So this completely ignores the plight of the landlord. Of course, it ignores more bigger principles like contracts and things like that. Maybe we can get into that. But just on a financial level, these are people who have invested, have created the supply of rental housing in the United States. All those people out there renting these homes and these apartments wouldn't exist for rent if not for landlords who maintain them, who actually build them often, or put together developments for rental for large multifamily units that then they can rent. This is the government basically saying you don't deserve your income. In pandemic, these people are more important than you. The government now is determining who the winners are, who the losers are, who should lose money, who should gain, who should benefit, and who should not. This is not the American way.
Government has been doing an awful lot of what you've just mentioned here in recent months. Yes. You referenced earlier the CARES Act and it putting a moratorium on evictions. Yaron, the CARES Act, has it provided any relief or assistance to the landlord, the property owner, so that if they cannot collect rent and they cannot evict, is there any way for the government, because they've caused this situation, to provide relief for them?
Not really. I mean, some of them might have been able to get access to the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP, if they had employees. They might have been something for, self-proprietorships, a small amount for that. Of course, there was for the renters. They got a $1,200 check, and if they're unemployed, they got their unemployment benefits supplemented by $600 and now $300. So there have been a variety of different ways in which the government has tried to support renters, but almost nothing in terms of landlords, either the small ones or the large ones. And of course, the CARES Act is over and there's no support going into next year. And look, it's a strange situation in America. You know, this is America, after all, where we start looking for government to support this group and that group, and we don't support this group, so we have to support another group. It's this spiraling effect of, you know, now the Realtors Association is putting pressure on the government to send their renters checks so they can pay the rent. So in order to solve a problem created by government, we load up other programs that will create other problems by government. We want to tax our grandchildren and our children and us in the future in order to support people today. Well, what about our children? What about their income? This whole idea that instead of finding solutions by which we free up the economy and actually get people working and actually get people producing, instead of that, we just print money and we start distributing is distortive and morally offensive and really fundamentally anti-American.
And this whole situation, when folks become unable to pay rent because their job has been taken away from them because some overly zealous, powerful governor decided to shut down their business. Is this a case where renters and their property owner or landlord ought to be talking to each other? Is there any mechanism for even getting partial rents to landlords so that they can cover at least their fixed costs here?
Well, the ideal would be exactly what you suggested. The ideal would be that renters and landlords negotiate this and solve it. Look, the landlord, if they evict everybody who can't pay a rent in an economic crisis, then who are they going to bring in? It's not like there are millions of people out there who now suddenly want to rent places.
We have been talking with Yaron Brook, who is chairman of the board of the Ayn Rand Institute. And Yaron, tell us a bit about the Ayn Rand Institute. Also, where can folks go on the web to learn more?
Sure. The Ayn Rand Institute is an organization set up to promote the ideas, the philosophy of the author Ayn Rand, the author of Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead. I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with those books. And you can find a vast array of information about her and her books at aynrand.org. That's AYNRAND.org.
Yaron Brooks, chairman of the board of the Ayn Rand Institute. Yaron, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Just when we thought the election year couldn't get any more interesting, it has, as we look toward the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice. Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on that for us as well. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about the political implications of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat becoming open and set for appointment at this particular time in the election calendar, what is the process that we will now go through to confirm a new justice?
We're going to see a little bit of time intervene after the nomination so that the Senate Judiciary Committee can review some more documents and also give the members additional time to review cases that they're interested in reading. But nonetheless, I think that we should really be expecting announcements that indicate this is going to have 3 days of hearings that week of October 13th. That really sets them up on a timeline where they can get confirmation of a nominee prior to Election Day.
And with Election Day rapidly approaching here, Scott, the obvious question becomes, what is the impact over this process occurring just weeks, just days before the general election? Do you see it as having a profound impact on the presidential race?
I think when there's going to be a close election and then it gets even more scrutinized by the voters, it builds enthusiasm. Right now, we're going to be having these presidential debates coming up. And so that's something next week to be thinking about with the presidential debate and how the moderator asks both candidates about their plan for judicial nominations in the future. I would also just kind of ask the listeners to think about the legacy that President Trump has in 3 nominations. That's a big accomplishment for any president to do. So I think that voters that prioritize the Supreme Court nominations in terms of their list of top issues are going to be really excited about what he's done, or they're going to be quite upset if you're on the far left and knowing that 3 consistent constitutionalists have been confirmed by the United States Senate following a nomination by the president.
We also have a third of the United States Senate up for election this year, Scott. And looking back to when Justice Kavanaugh was confirmed, there were, I believe, 4 Democrat senators who voted against Kavanaugh, who were subsequently defeated when they ran for re-election by Republicans. Right now, we have a number of Republican seats that are in jeopardy. Does this help those candidates, or does it lend more toward the Democrat side?
I think for some of the candidates, it's going to help them. I think for a candidate like Lindsey Graham, who's going to be the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, this shows his state, South Carolina, the weight that he brings in terms of his ability to lead on major issues. And certainly the Judiciary Committee is a big, big committee during these confirmation battles. So I think that Lindsey Graham is definitely much safer on Election Day than he would have been otherwise. I still think he would have won re-election, but that's just a prediction. I don't have any insider information on that one. I think he's in a safe seat, though. Additionally, you're looking at Susan Collins in Maine, Tom Tillis in North Carolina, as a couple of really important senators on maintaining that Senate majority line and seeing whether they can pull off their races. Those are going to be Election Day toss-up races, in my opinion.
One of the things that we've seen happen in these recent confirmation battles, Scott, is the Democrats, the left, will throw anything and everything against the nominee they can possibly either find or make up or even dream of. And we've already seen in the run-up to President Trump's announcement of the nominee, we've already seen attacks on Amy Coney Barrett because of her religion. Now, Amy Coney Barrett is Catholic, which is, at least in my mind, a mainstream religion in this country. Are we going to see this sort of scenario unfold once again, where everything from religion to what somebody did in high school is played out before the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Yeah, I think that there will certainly be an opportunity for those sorts of questions from senators. I do think that during her previous confirmation in 2017, Amy Coney Barrett got into an exchange with Senator Dianne Feinstein, where Dianne Feinstein said, quote, "the dogma lives loudly within you," and end quote. I think that listeners need to be reminded that there is no religious test on nominations, and that's a constitutional provision. So it's not in line for senators to be asking that sort of questioning, but it's certainly been part of the conversation as President Trump considered the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Amy Coney Barrett.
Looking forward then to this confirmation vote, Scott, Republicans hold 53 seats in the U.S. Senate. You need 51 to confirm, or 50 plus the Vice President Mike Pence. At this point, does it look like Republicans have the votes to confirm President Trump's nominee?
I think that the confirmation is in a very, very good spot. And I think that as the American people watch this process unfold of a qualified constitutionalist on the court, I think that a lot of people will be pretty comfortable with the direction that we decided to go.
We, of course, will continue to keep an eye on this, as well as policy battles and elections all around the country, with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, check out clubforgrowth.org or our Twitter handle at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks.
California is once again having a difficult forest fire season, and some are blaming climate change for making the problem worse. But is climate change at fault? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Myron Ebell of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Parts of the western United States have looked like scenes out of an apocalyptic movie in recent weeks, as the glow of wildfires and the smoke that they've created has sort of blocked out the sun, turned everything red, looks like an Instagram filter all the time. The fires, thankfully, have kind of died down now, but the cost of them has just been huge. Dozens of people have died, thousands of homes have burned, and some people say that this is all the result of global warming. And while that might be a contributing factor, there are some other, much more tangible things that have also made the Western wildfires worse. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Myron Ebell. He is the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he joins us now on the phone to talk about this very important environmental issue, these wildfires across California and Oregon. Myron, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
We're glad to have you, Myron. You've written a lot about this issue over the years and recently as well at CEI.org. And there's really a number of competing issues here. But one thing that you've singled out is the role of state regulations in California and how the state really prevents people from doing just sort of common sense things on their own property to keep these fires from getting as bad as they do.
Yes. Well, some of the fires, most of the fires, the big catastrophic fires are in the forest, but there's a lot of fires in the chaparral along the coastal California hills. And I don't know if people have ever driven through that area, but there's hills and then there's scrubland, and that's called chaparral. Chaparral grows up in the years that are wet, and California has about 3 wet years out of every 10. The other 7, it's in drought. And when these wet years, the chaparral grows up, and then when you get a drought, it's going to burn. And that's how chaparral maintains itself. So there's no way out of that. And why is it so bad? Well, because the state and local governments have shut down the necessary management to keep the fires under control. The first is fire breaks, bulldozing fire breaks so that once the fire starts, it'll stop somewhere. And the second is more and more people live in the coastal hills of California. Many of them have built big, grand houses, and they aren't allowed to actually prevent fires around their houses. They can't clear fire breaks without going to the county and state governments to get a permit to clear the chaparral and the brush, the scrub around their houses. So that's why we're seeing so many houses burn down. So it's really just criminal mismanagement.
So we've got questionable management at the state level, but then most of these fires, most of the really big ones, have been on national forest land. So that means the federal government owns that land. You've highlighted some issues there, too, specifically relating to logging. The federal government owns all of this land in the western United States. And by and large, people just aren't allowed to go in there. You're not allowed to cut down the trees. And that's a contributing factor here, too.
Yes, that's right. And if to those people who are saying that global warming is the cause, then I would just ask, why is it that global warming only seems to be burning up our national forests and not our privately owned forests? There are some fires in the privately owned forests in Oregon, Washington, and California, but they're not most. I haven't heard of a catastrophic one. Not what's happening in the national forests. And the reason for that is because starting in 1990, throughout the next decade, there was a radical reduction in logging on our national forests. So the national forests throughout the 1980s produced an average of 12 billion board feet of timber a year. By 2000, you're down to 2 billion board feet. And up to 2017, when President Trump took office, we're still well under 3 billion board feet. So you've gone from 12 billion to 2 to 3 billion. And what's the result? Well, it's been estimated that tree growth annually in our national forests is between 14 and 17 billion board feet. So if you're only cutting 2 or 3, you're going to have a massive fuel buildup. And eventually, unless you log it, you're going to have fire. And that's what's happened. And there's so much fuel buildup that these fires are incredibly intense, and they're just catastrophic.
We are talking with Myron Ebel from the Competitive Enterprise Institute about the wildfires that are raging and scarring large parts of the Western United States in recent weeks. And Myron, one of the interesting dynamics here to me is the fact that it is that you just alluded to this, the fact that these same people who are out there telling us this is global warming that's causing these fires, they're the ones who have lobbied for and have pushed for many of these regulations that have actually very tangibly made the fires worse. Am I getting that right?
Yes, absolutely. The Sierra Club has been officially opposed to all commercial logging in the national forest since 1996. They are the lead group that has been responsible for the change in policy by Congress and the Forest Service that has shut down the national forest from timber production. And moreover, when the fires first broke out, the executive director of the Sierra Club immediately sent out an email, a statement saying, well, you see, we've been warning you, this is the consequence of global warming, and we've got to do something about global warming. Well, if global warming is part of this, then we've got to do a lot more management. We have to do a lot more logging, because global warming will just make the catastrophic fires worse. So, and we're not going to end global warming in the next 5 years or 10 years. That's a 50 to 100-year project. So the Sierra Club and their allies in Congress are directly responsible for these fires. It's not man-made global warming. It's man-made policies.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good way of thinking about this. To the extent that global warming is a problem that needs to be addressed, it's a long-term thing. It's obviously not something we're going to solve tomorrow, but you could solve some of these other things tomorrow or next week or next year. You could change these federal regulations and state regulations that are actively making the fires worse. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. Myron Ebel from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Thanks, Eric.
And again, that is Myron Ebel. He is the director of the Center for Energy and Environment at CEI. You can check out his work at CEI.org. You can follow everything that we're covering as far as the Western wildfires go, the campaign trail, the presidential race, all of that at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Tearing down statues, rioting in the streets, disrupting societal institutions, all are tactics straight out of the Karl Marx playbook. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary.
Among the many questions I've received in doing interviews on my new book, The Devil and Karl Marx, has been one particularly interesting question. What does Karl Marx have to do with today's anti-statue movement? That is, the movement storming streets and towns with chains and spray cans, vandalizing and tearing down statues. These are, of course, no longer just statues of Confederate generals. No, we're way beyond that. They now include Union generals who defeated the Confederacy, i.e. Ulysses S. Grant, no less than Abraham Lincoln, even black abolitionist Frederick Douglass. Try to figure that one out. These folks would rip down Mount Rushmore if they could. What do these figures have to do with George Floyd or police reform? Well, nothing, obviously. But they do represent a tearing at the very fabric of our nation, culture, and its social and political order. They literally seek to tear down. And alas, it's there that the comparison to Karl Marx is apt, regardless of whether those tearing down could even spell the words Communist Manifesto. The goal of Marx and the Marxist Project from the outset was one of fundamental transformation. Marx's ideas were so radical and so, as Marx put it, contrary to the nature of things, that they inevitably raised the foundation. Marx in the Manifesto said that communism represents, quote, the most radical rupture in traditional relations. It seeks to abolish the present state of things. That's no small task. In a remarkable statement, Marx and Engels in the Manifesto wrote that communists, quote, openly declare that their ends can be attained only by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. Chew that one over. They close the manifesto by writing, quote, communists everywhere support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things, unquote. In a letter to his friend Arnold Ruge, Marx called for the ruthless criticism of all that exists. Imagine. And Marx was particularly fond of a line from Mephistopheles. Yes, Mephistopheles, who in Goethe's play Faust is the demon, the devil-like character. And that line was, everything that exists deserves to perish. If you know what Goethe's Faust was about and who Mephistopheles was, then you know that's a rather chilling thought from Karl Marx. Beyond ruthless criticism from Marx, there was ruthless abolition. As Marx biographer Robert Payne noted, the word almost seems to jump off every page of the manifesto. Payne observed, and after Marx has abolished property, family, nations, and all existing societies and social conditions, he shows little interest in creating a new society on the ruins of the old. Marx would wander through the kingdom of ruins. The Communist Manifesto was the gauntlet that he threw at the world. Yes, it was indeed. And it wasn't merely the manifesto. A key focus of my book on Marx is Marx's genuinely hellacious poetry and plays, which display a savage obsession with the dark side. Marx wrote of suicide pacts, pacts with the devil, of, quote, hellish vapors, of the prince of darkness selling a blood-dark sword that shall stab unerringly within thy soul. His poem, of heaven I forfeited, I know it full well, my soul, once true to God, is chosen for hell. Marx wrote of violence, vengeance, flames, rage, death, despair, and destruction. In short, Karl Marx wanted to burn down the house. And again, not a single revolutionary standing with torches aside a statue in this or that town need quote Karl Marx in the process. Marx, however, would approve of them in this sense. As he said in the manifesto, communists support every revolutionary movement that goes against the existing social and political order. So as long as today's revolutionaries are seeking that purpose, Marx would surely approve. They exhibit, whether they know it or not, common cause with Marx's desire to tear down. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, The Devil and Karl Marx.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KCLC-FM in St. Charles, Missouri. Welcome to our new listeners in the Show Me State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.